update. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have to be nice to you again, but later in the meeting. And now, papers three. Rotate the staff a little bit here. Michelle, are you taking the lead on this?
Yes, essentially.
Okay. Your mic's on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. At this session of the Interpretation Committee meeting, we would like to conclude the discussions on the draft interpretation foreign currency transactions and advanced consideration as set out in Agenda Papers 3. The draft of interpretation was issued in October 2015 and the comment period ended on the 19th of January 2016. And the committee considered the feedback at its meeting in May when we started to discuss some of the key comments raised. The committee will recall that the feedback to the draft interpretation is positive and many of the matters raised in the comment letters were considered to be of a drafting nature. As a consequence, there were few significant matters to be discussed with the committee and we structured our papers so we just brought the significant matters to you. At this session, we would like to try and conclude our deliberations of the matters received and to review the due process steps. If the committee agrees that it is satisfied with the due process steps, we'll request permission to start the balloting process. I will discuss the first two topics in Agenda Paper 3A before handing over to Adjorna and Sung Ho. The first topic is transactions with a significant financing component, set out in paragraphs 5 to 11 of Agenda Paper 3A. At the May 2016 committee meeting, we were asked to develop an example of a transaction with a significant financing component. And although the committee asked us to try and use current examples that were included in the draft interpretation, on reflection, we decided it would be better to insert a new example. And this would leave the current examples with clarity about the point they were demonstrating rather than adding an additional element to an existing example. We felt when we looked at each of the examples, if we added on a significant financing component, we were probably losing some of the clarity. Consequently, we're recommending that we include in the final interpretation the example as proposed in paragraph 7, although we may need to do some tweaking to the words. The other topic that we agreed to bring back to the committee was the subject of embedded derivatives that was raised by one of the constituents in the comment letters. We have discussed that matter with the constituent, and on reflection, we think we're not recommending that the committee makes any adjustment to the draft interpretation for this item. This is because, firstly, we think that paragraph 24 of IFRS 21 is clear that an entity first applies the relevant standard, in this case that would be IFRS 9 or IAS 39, before it applies IAS 21, and also because we think it's unlikely that these transactions will occur frequently, that is transactions that include an embedded derivative where the host contract is not in the entity's functional currency. So I will hand over to Adjorna before we take questions, if that's okay.
Thank you, Michelle. So paragraph 17 described.
Yeah, we need to get... Now you're on.
Okay, thank you. The paragraph 17 onwards discuss the cost of implementation for this particular interpretation. And from the inception itself, it was clear that unless the Interpretation Committee allows both multi-transaction and single transaction method to continue, that we would have some costs for preparers. What we have analyzed is those costs for preparers in transition. And what we believe is that on the benefit side, having analyzed the usefulness of the information, that the improved comparability to the investors would allow them to assess the entity's exposure to foreign currency risk. From the cost side, preparers would have initial costs related to changing the system, but there is no ongoing costs that we can foresee. So on balance, regarding the comments that we have received, as well as the feedback that we have received in addition to, by saying that by implementing the draft interpretation along with the IFRS 15, or aligning the effective dates with IFRS 15, that any costs would be minimized. So we have taken those feedback into consideration when we discussed the cost of the implementation bit. Do I continue to the effective date as well? Because it conveniently puts that into the discussion about the effective date. So taking the point I just mentioned and looking at the feedback that was received for the exposure draft, where almost all of the commenters agreed with the Interpretations Committee's original decision to align the effective date of the interpretation with IFRS 15 effective date, the staff had recommended in the paper that we stick to that, which would be 1st of January 2018 with earlier application permitted. So that those are the two sections that that we wanted to discuss.
So if we could turn to the first two questions that are set out after paragraph 35 in Agenda Paper 3A. And first of all, we would like to ask the Interpretations Committee if it agrees with the staff recommendation not to address embedded derivative, and that the effective date of the interpretation should be 1 January 2018.
Okay, you skipped over the question of the example.
No, well, I left the example in the example is in question two.
Oh, okay.
Where we just asked for further comments. So we need a decision for question one, and then we can discuss question two.
Okay, comments? Okay, Bonnie?
Bertrand Perrin from Vivendi. I'm attending by call. I'm sorry I joined late.
Okay.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm very sorry I've joined late. I couldn't connect via video conference. I have just so I'm joining the IFRS Interpretation Committee. It's my first meeting today, and I just have a question on why such an interpretation. Probably you already discussed that in the past in previous meetings, but if you could just answer to this very simple question, why such an interpretation on such a subject? What was the need expressed and the problems to solve there?
So the draft interpretation was issued. I think the Interpretations Committee had probably four or five discussions before they issued the draft interpretation. But there was a question that was posed to the interpretation meeting asking how to determine the exchange rate when applying IAS 21 for the recognition of revenue when advance consideration has been received in a foreign currency. And the Interpretations Committee did some outreach, and they observed that there were different exchange rates being used for the recognition of revenue where there was advance consideration. They also noted that the issue went beyond just receiving advance consideration for revenue, and concluded that it would be useful to issue an interpretation. And generally, the feedback we got to the interpretation was positive. So at this meeting, we're just concluding our deliberations.
I would agree, Bertrand, with your observation. This is a issue somewhat unlike some of our other interpretations, somewhat narrower. But I agree with Michelle. The committee looked at this and concluded that there was diversity in practice, and given the advent of IFRS 15 in particular, it would be useful to pursue this. Bonnie, you had wanted to come in.
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. I do agree with the staff not to add anything to address the embedded derivatives. I think that's a very narrow circumstance, and I agree that there is enough guidance and other pieces of literature to address that. I also agree with the effective date. However, I guess I'm not of the view that it is strictly linked to IFRS 15, so I think our rationale should It's kind of in the second sentence of paragraph 34, just indicating that we think the effective date should not be earlier than the effective date of IFRS 15, not necessarily what's said in the first sentence that the effective date should be aligned with that of IFRS 15. So it's a small clarification, but I think it's an important one because I don't think that these are linked. I think this is a separate issue, but I do agree with the staff's recommendation on the effective date.
Okay. Okay, who is that waving his hand here? I can't. Bruce, that's what I thought of. Bruce, please go ahead.
Hi, can you all hear me?
I hope so.
Thanks. I had a similar comment to Bonnie. I agree with the embedded derivative answer, and I agree with the 1st of January 2018 answer. I guess my only question was just on the linkage as well. I mean, if we're linking this to IFRS 15, you know, just a concern about that as well, given that, you know, we know many situations we've come across which is not necessarily an IFRS 15 issue on this. So I have the same concern that just to be careful that people don't see this as purely an IFRS 15 issue. This is potentially outside of that as well. But other than that, I agree with the recommendation.
Tony? Hit the button once more. There you go.
So I'm comfortable with the recommendation about the effective date. I'm probably in a slightly different place in connection with embedded derivatives. So I understand what paragraph 24 of IAS 21 says. And I agree that you do need to look to other standards. I think the comment at the beginning of paragraph 14 that paragraph 24 of IAS 21 clearly requires an entity to first evaluate transactions for embedded derivatives may be giving people a little bit too much credit for making the link. So I'm not sure everybody would automatically read that and say, have I got an embedded derivative? And once I've bifurcated it, do I still have a foreign currency host? I just don't think people necessarily get there. I'm probably inclined to agree with the staff, we don't need to put anything in the interpretation, but I wonder, given that we've now had this conversation, whether there is a sentence that could go in the basis that might point people in the right direction.
I think that's a valid observation. John, did you want to come in?
Just to say that I agree with the staff recommendation not to address embedded derivatives, although I think Tony's suggestion of a comment in the basis is probably not unhelpful. And on the effective date.
That phrasing with faint damn, I think.
And on the effective date, I agree with 1 January 2018, but I wouldn't have any linkage or rationale for that being anything to do with IFRS 15. I think this is an IAS 21 interpretation. So I think the effective date can stand on its own as 1 Jan 2018.
Okay. Andrew, do you want to come in?
Sure. Thank you. Just on the embedded derivative point, I think I had a similar notion to Tony's that in reading this, I rather thought it would be helpful for people to have a reminder. If I think of live questions that we quite frequently get, I suspect without that, there's a danger that people would miss it. On the question of effective date, although I agree that there isn't necessarily a linkage to IFRS 15 per se, it is also true that on the adoption of IFRS 15, a number of entities might make changes to their internal systems. And therefore, because they might need to change systems for this, they could do it in one go.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, I'm having a little trouble recognizing people on the screen, but Yongsu, and then Martin, but let's do Yongsu first.
All right, I just agree with the staff analysis and conclusion. I just want to make one comment about the effective date. I agree with the other people that the advance payment is not always related to rapid recognition, but nevertheless, I think most of the time, the advance payments arises from the rapid recognition. So aligning the date of the interpretation with the date of the IFRS 15 will minimize the implementation costs as well as conceptually or the projectionally wise, it's related. So I agree with this step analysis.
Okay. Martin?
Yeah, I also agree with the staff analysis. However, I also believe, due to implementation issues, that I know it's linked to IRIS 21, but however, I guess the effective date then should not be later than the effective date of IFRS 15, probably not written in the document, but a line timing. However, I have another issue which was not discussed. However, I believe it's important for transition. We talked about embedded, and I agree that we could scope out this with regard to the interpretation. At least, however, I would expect some wording on existing hedge documentations in place, because companies have more or less valid hedge documentation based on the former interpretation, and now we come up with this new interpretation. What does this that mean for hedge accounting? So this is probably an issue which in a way should be, well, should be a little bit more guidance on that with regard to transition methods and so on.
Okay, that would significantly, I think, expand things. Comments around the table here?
We'd have to go away and look at what need to be put in place, I think.
Okay. Mary?
Just on that point, a question. Was that a comment that came in at all in the comment letters in response to the draft interpretation?
No, the only
yes. Question... Yes, it was. At least in one comment letter it was included.
I thought the only, well, maybe I, the only comment I thought on embedded derivatives was in the PwC letter. I don't remember another letter.
I was not talking about embedded derivatives. I was talking about this hedging issue. Hedging documentation. Because for corporates, it is really an issue.
So what would change about hedging documentation as a consequence of this interpretation? That's, I think, what some of us are struggling with.
Because the documentation is already there.
If you have the documentation in place, and we've said, look to the existing guidance on embeddeds, how does this interpretation place your hedging documentation in jeopardy?
Yeah, the question is, what revenue, if you have anticipated exposure with regard to revenue, what rate are you hedging, so to say? Are you hedging the rate when the service is delivered, although you got an advance payment, or is it in the hedging documentation that you focus more or less on the spot rate on the date of the advance payment? So there could be differences, and we haven't considered that.
Comments? Trina?
Well, I noticed, Bob, you have your hand up, and I don't know whether, do you want to comment around this hedge documentation or more widely? Because you might have an answer.
We can always count on Bob for an answer. Bob, please.
No, sorry, I don't have an answer to that. I had another issue that I wanted to raise about the embedded, so I'll defer to others who want to answer the hedging question first. Well,
maybe I'll just ask the question back to Martin then. So, Martin, are you saying and thinking about this that you think allowing more than a year of implementation time, you know, if we were to set 1 January 2018, you think that is insufficient for people to look at their hedge documentation in the event that they were doing it in a different way?
The smart answer is always, it depends. I'm pretty sure that there are companies who have long-lasting contracts with upfronts or so over 3 or 4 years. With regard to our company, we would be fine. We would be fine anyhow. It's not a topic of our company or so. But with regard of hints I got from industry, it said that they have longer lasting hedging documentation, and this should probably something one should consider.
Kumar, did you want to come in? Kumar has joined us, and he actually knows about this stuff.
Yeah, I haven't thought about the issue, Martin, but I was trying to understand, because most probably this will be a hedge of foreign currency risk, which will be a cash flow hedge most probably, I'm guessing. And you are hedging variability in cash flows arising. Is your concern that what is the base point with which you start the hedging in the documentation? Because people say changes due to spot rates.
Please go ahead, Martin.
Sorry, is that your concern?
Yeah, might be one. I mean, I'm not sure. I don't know how the hedge documentation is set up of companies. Yeah. So, however, they focus on expected service, expected delivery of products, invoiced in foreign currency. So it might be that they got already an upfront payment, but I'm not sure what they have documented with regard to hedge account. Probably one should do, I wouldn't say an official outreach or so, but probably collect some facts and circumstances, whether it could be true or not.
Here's the point which I was right. Because it's an advance payment, it's already on my balance sheet. I don't think anybody hedges that, because already your Forex movements are going through P&L, and if you have a derivative, you're already matched. So could be some circumstances, because I haven't explored this, but normally those both ends are matched, and I haven't seen people designate them in a hedging relationship. Because you certainly, if it's on your balance sheet, I don't think you could designate the forward rate on that, because it's a balance sheet spot for spot movement. So to even get a hedge accounting advantage for the forward points, which you could defer, that doesn't apply, because that gets flushed through P&L. So I'm not sure how much of an issue this will be from a hedging perspective. But again, this is just, I'm at the table, I've just heard this. I would be surprised if this were a big hedging issue, and especially with a transition period of 1 year.
Katrina?
I was going to say, could I suggest that we, I suppose, take other comments around this and reach a decision today, and if it's helpful, we can certainly perhaps go back and look at whoever the specific stakeholders were that perhaps raised this in the comment letter, speak to them about this to clarify whether they anticipate, and obviously if anything arises out of that, we could bring it back to the committee.
I have to say, in my reading of the comment letters, this one didn't strike me, so doesn't mean it wasn't there, just means I'm not smart enough to recognize it. So we will circle back on that, and Martin will work with you to make sure that we've covered the base on this. Bob, you want to...
Okay, thanks, Wayne.
Bob and then Jim.
Yeah, a couple points. One, I agree with the proposed effective date for this. I also agree with the staff not to address embedded. So I have, was going to have the same suggestion. I agree with Tony. I think it would be smart to put this in the basis for conclusion. The one question I had for the staff, I just wanted to make sure my understanding was correct. On transition, we're allowing a prospective transition on application of this interpretation. But I'm supposing that that transition does not apply to embedded derivatives. We're not directly addressing embedded derivatives, so I wouldn't think that the relief or prospective would also apply to them. Am I correct?
That would be my understanding. Yeah. The staff is agreeing with that.
Because I think we're not changing the requirements for embedded derivatives or finding them, so it wouldn't affect it.
Hey, Bob, you had, you said you had a couple there?
No, that was just that one.
Just that one, okay. Jim, you had your hand up. Okay, I think you still have the mute on, Jim. Can you, we can see you, but we can't hear you.
Sorry, Bob.
Still no luck. Jim, we're not hearing you at all. we're going to go get some help. While we wait to see what our problem is with Jim's connection, are there others who want to come in?
Hi, Wayne. Carl Douglas.
Yes, Carl,
question
please.
Question one. I do agree with staff's recommendation. I would leave embedded derivatives out of this interpretation at all, and the effective data support as well, especially with the early application permission. I've received a lot of positive feedback about this interpretation from the preparers community, and people are eager to apply it as soon as possible.
Okay, Jim, I'm informed that whatever issue there is, we can't fix it from here, which is not helpful to you at all. You're shaking your head, yes. So.
The only alternative is that if you try to dial in through the audio, the telephone line, then perhaps we could hear you in that way.
Okay, let's give him a minute to try and do that. Any other comments?
If he can't hear us, we have to email him so that he can correspond to him right now. But
he's trying to work on it, isn't it?
Muted his speaker, so he can't hear us. Clearly stop somebody with movement.
Jim, can you hold your hand up if you can hear us? All right, he hears us. We just can't hear him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so his mic, he must have muted his mic.
He's going to talk. Okay, I'm told that the problem may be that you have muted.
Perhaps come out and go back in.
Turn off your mic or...
He's gone.
He's gone. So we'll hope he gets back in. All right. You want to proceed with the due process paper?
Well, we haven't quite got there. So in terms of question one, in relation to the embedded derivatives, it appears that most people are suggesting that we mention something in the basis of conclusions and we'll go away and look at this point on the documentation. And then it appears the committee agrees with the suggestion of 1 January 2018 for the effective date, but that we shouldn't link it, link it to IFRS 15. So the next question we had for the committee was, we just wanted to see if you had any comments on the illustrative example or the costs of implementing the interpretation.
Comments? Reactions?
Tom? Yes, please. We believe that the example provides is very useful. However, we were wondering if it could be clarified why the accretion of 10 is translated by the exchange rate over the period. Because we are not sure that it is immediately clear from what is in the interpretation. When you read the interpretation, then they say you have to take the exchange rate at the moment of the receipt of the cash.
Excuse me.
For the 10, there is no receipt. So we thought it might be clarified why you take that the exchange rate over the period. And a second suggestion is to include in the example how the difference between the financing component and the converted amount should be accounted for. Thank you.
Okay.
Michelle?
So I'm not necessarily sure we'd want to justify in the example how we are applying this the standard, but we can look at it in drafting.
if that's okay. And I'm sorry, I didn't quite get the second point you were making about the difference between the financing charge.
How to account for it? There is a difference of 10, which is added as interest. But how to account for the exchange rate differences that might arise?
All right. Okay. Oh yes. Okay. We can do that. Yeah. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
Okay, Jim. You appear to have come back to us. Can you speak now?
Yes. Let's try it one more time. How about now?
We can hear you now.
Okay, good. Nice to be back. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you for all of you, and it's truly my honor to be here. And just back to this question, I do agree with the recommendations the staff made. And there's no need to address on the derivatives issue. But I do have one concern, and I agree with, I guess, Bonnie's comment a moment ago that we should simplify our approach toward this issue. But it appears to me that the example is kind of too simple to be true. And I'm not sure giving out this very simplified example could help the readers to cut this specific component out of the whole complicated transactions. As we know right now, foreign currency exchange issue is getting more sensitive in the practical world due to the realities and the craziness happening in the marketplace. So I think just by adding those words and making our opinions out should help the accountants to understand, and just giving the overly simplified examples might be a little bit misleading, because in the field, people will be very difficult to simplify as this example says. So that's my concern. But at the end of the day, I have to agree with the recommendations. That's it.
Okay,
thank you,
Jim, and welcome aboard. Bob?
Good to be here.
Yeah, I had a question on the example. I don't disagree with it and including it. But the example is set up as they were supposed to pay a different currency of 100, and they just allow that to be paid at 90 now. Now, when you have a significant financing, that is there's a hypothetical interest payment in here. If this was set up as, well, you pay 90 now and you'll get in the different currency and you'll get the goods or services in 14 months time, could someone assume that that interest, because again, it's hypothetical, would be paid in their own functional currency, and therefore are not, that piece would not be in 21?
It's all in foreign currency in the same foreign currency.
Yeah, I think all the staff mics are on, and I think the answer was yes.
Well, the answer is it's all in the foreign currency. So points A and B, say the 90 is in the foreign currency, and the 10 would be, the 10 interest would be paid in the foreign currency as well.
Well, but the 10 is really never paid, right? The 10 is paid in the goods or services. I understand the example you're saying that, well, the agreement was to sell it for 100 in the foreign currency, but accepting 90 now. So I get the example, but if they never specified the 100 and only specified pay 90 now, receive delivery in 14 months time, it's equivalent to saying, okay, well, I will receive the 90 now, I'll convert it immediately, and then I pay you back in my own currency some amount equivalent to the fair value of the goods or services in 14 months' time, which would be then, in effect, paying the interest, the financing component, in my own functional currency.
I don't think that's how we saw it. I think we saw it that the example we were illustrating was that you had 100 in the foreign currency and you allocated it 90 and 10. And I accept the earlier point that the 10 might change because of the foreign currency differences, and we should explain what happened with those. But if you want, I think what you're suggesting is a slightly different example where you have 90 is paid in the foreign currency and 10 is in a different currency. But that, I think, is a complexity beyond this example. We were just trying to have a simple example of a transaction. Although I think this might be overly simplified. We might need to.
Well, to some degree, though, the example is perhaps just actually, it's illustrating the same thing that's illustrated in example 29, but it's just saying now assume that example 29 in IFRS 15 is in foreign currency. How does that transaction then get translated back into the entity's reporting currency? So maybe that's just a way of further making sure that this doesn't become sort of an interpretation around IFRS 15 is to effectively link it very directly back to the example that's already in IFRS 15 and just say, let's just assume that's in the foreign currency and then you're translating back.
Does that work for you, Michelle?
Yeah, we can do
okay. Bob, would that work for you? Does that answer your question?
I think so. I like I said before, I'm okay with the example the way it is. Mine was an additional question. I understand it adds more complexity and not to deal with it, not to directly address it.
John?
I mean, I was okay with the example, but to Bob's point, I mean, there's an assumption in the example that the financing component is in the foreign currency denomination of the contract and not in your domestic currency. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I don't think anywhere in IFRS 15 there's a presumption that the financing component is in the same currency as the currency of the contract. I mean, it seems to me reasonable, but I think that's effectively an interpretation of IFRS 15.
Well, I don't think we were clearly not aiming to interpret IFRS 15. So we probably just need to set out when we draft this, when we put this in the interpretation, clearly the facts and circumstances.
Tony?
Yeah, I must admit I've wondered the same thing because this is a payment in advance. So, as Bob said, the 10 never actually gets paid. It's an accretion of interest to increase the contract liability, which then becomes revenue.
Yep.
So it never actually gets paid. So I'm not sure there is anything anywhere that says that has to be in the foreign currency rather than being in the functional currency. So I think that gets back to the first question, why? And I'm not sure... It's an assumption in here, but I'm not sure there is anything in the guidance that says because you got paid in the foreign currency, you have to assume that the accretion of the interest is also in the foreign currency.
I'm having difficulty understanding why you would assume anything else. What am I missing?
I mean, there's no longer any currency risk. You've received the currency. So... having been paid in advance, do you have to assume that you would accrete the interest also in the foreign currency?
As opposed to accreting it in my functional currency?
Yes.
Sue, you're looking confused. Sue, you want to repeat that now the mic's on?
Tell the world I don't have anything useful to say. No, I think, isn't the simple assumption in here that because the transaction was in the foreign currency that it would make sense to be thinking about the alternative of I pay in the future versus today as being all in the foreign currency?
I mean, you're saying the whole, your whole comparative base about, I'm trying to get back to the revenue that, you know, the price that they would have paid in cash at the time of the sale, and that's all in foreign currency. They prepaid in foreign currency, so I've now, and they determined there's a significant financing, so I'm just, you know, just translating that.
But is, was the question that Bob started with sort of saying, if the alternative was to pay 90 foreign currency today and a different amount in my functional currency in the future, would I somehow analyse it differently? Was that?
Well, I think you can.
I think that was it. I think maybe what Bob was getting at, and maybe Tony is saying, is by doing this, are we sort of superimposing a requirement that every time you have advanced consideration in a foreign currency, that would involve financing, you'd automatically, you know, almost take it as given that you, you assume the interest is in foreign currency.
Can we solve this by just clarifying the assumptions underlying the example? Say, we have assumed that. Go ahead. Andrew, you wanted to come in?
Thank you. I think when I listen to this discussion, I think back to how the significant financing component should work. Because 15 will tell you that you look at it from the perspective of whoever is receiving the financing, which in this case is a seller. And I don't think it matters particularly whether you accrete in the foreign currency or the functional currency, because if you use appropriate forward rates and interest rate differentials, you'll come back to the same answer. So perhaps the way to deal with it in the example, and sorry, there was one other point. On the accretion, the other thing that it might be worth just thinking about a little bit is that there is an example in IFRS 15 which has a payment in advance or a payment on completion, but the accretion is not for the difference between these two amounts because the borrowing rate for whoever gets the financing is different. So in this example, perhaps the way to shortcut quite a lot of analysis would be to build in an assumption that the difference between 90 and 100 reflects the borrowing rate for the seller at the date in which the prepayment is received. And then and then you're not focusing on foreign currency, you're focusing on the appropriate borrowing rate.
Yes.
Good point. I think that in my own inarticulate way, that's kind of where I was at. All right, we can deal with this then.
Okay. So if that's the case, I think that concludes questions one and two. And we've had a look again at the transitional relief. Remember, we previously discussed this in the May meeting. We just wanted to raise a further point with you. So Song Ho is just going to go through that point with you.
Yes. The step analysis of transitional requirements starts at paragraph 36 of the agenda paper 3A. As Michelle mentioned, at its meeting in May 2016, the committee decided to retain the transition requirements in the draft interpretation and provide the first-time adopters of IFRS standard with the same transitional relief as it provided to the entity already applying the standard. We have considered further the provision of relief to the first-time adopter and note if a first-time adopter is provided with the same transitional relief as an entity already applying IFRS standards, it can choose a paragraph A2B1 of the draft interpretation. Paragraph A2B1 does not require an entity to present full comparative information. Other standards and interpretation which provide transitional relief to the first-time adopters generally require comparative information. Also, we note that if transition relief is provided for the transaction within the scope of this interpretation, different transition provisions apply for the first-time adopter depending on the payment terms of the asset, income, or expense. This is because the interpretation interprets only one aspect of IAS 21 and first-time adopters are not provided with the relief in applying order required in IAA 21. Consequently, we recommend that the committee does not provide transition relief for the first-time adopters. Does the committee have any other comments or questions on this matter?
First-time adopters, comments? Young-soo?
I just want to say I agree with the staff conclusion. To me, the comparative information is very important, especially for the first-time adopters. So I agree with the staff in removing the A to B1 from condition relief. Thank you.
Okay. Others? I've forgotten who's on the phone. Of those of you who are on audio, are there any comments?
Carl Douglas, I would keep some relief for first-time adopters. I think might work well the suggestion in the final of the paragraph 49, some alternative approach to keep some level of relief.
I'm not clear on what you're suggesting, Carl.
The last sentence of paragraph 49, nonetheless, there is a good alternative approach to keep some relief for first-time adopters, not a full relief.
Okay. Let me, before I go to John, are there others on the audio who want to come in? Oh. Okay, John? Yeah, you need to unmute your microphone, John. We can't read lips.
I am unmuted. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Okay. I agree with the recommendation not to permit the use of A2B1 because I think that is not compatible with IFRS 1. But I would provide the relief in A2B2 because I think full retrospective application of this interpretation for first-time adopters is going to be problematic and very onerous. So I would provide the relief in A2B2, which I think is the same suggestion Carl had about the last sentence in paragraph 49 of the paper.
Katrina?
Sorry, John, can I just ask why you think it would be very onerous? Are there particular transactions? Or?
Well, I think this applies to not only to revenue and expense transactions, it applies to asset purchases and could effective, you know, full retrospectivity of this would effectively require to go back and look at past acquisitions of those of assets in foreign currencies and whether they were had been appropriately translated into local currency. That seems to me to be quite an onerous requirement. Now, I know IFRS 1 does have some relief for inability to retrospectively apply property PP&E accounting by use of the fair value as deemed cost, but I think forcing first-time adopters to use that when we could provide relief from this requirement, I think is, I just don't see the harm in providing the relief that's in A2B2 to first-time adopters.
No, I mean, just to let you know, I mean, the only reason I was thinking about it feeds more of the fact that IFRS 1 doesn't provide any relief from applying any other aspect of IAS 21. So for me, if I were, you know, a first-time adopter, even though I may have to look back, and I'm going to have to do that anyway in applying, you know, kind of every other paragraph of IAS 21. So it just seemed to be that providing relief for this one interpretation and this one aspect wouldn't necessarily provide very much relief at all when they would have to go back in time and apply all of the other requirements in IAS 21, you know, fully as is required by IAS 21.
John, did you have any more on that?
No, I mean that's, I mean that may be fair enough. I haven't done a detailed analysis of how much relief this really would provide, given the retrospective application of 21 in other respects. But just seemed to me that it didn't seem to me to be that much of a stretch to provide this transition relief. We were still going to require them on the transition date to apply this interpretation, because we wouldn't. I mean, I would not allow A2B1. It seemed to me A2B2 wasn't too much of a wouldn't result in too much lack of comparability by permitting that in as part of IFRS 1 adoption.
Andrew?
Thank you. I think that I would agree A2B1 would not be permitted under IFRS 1. Like John, I'm minded to give the relief in A2B2. And it may not be directly within IS 21, but there is another adjustment which could potentially go back rather a long way in foreign exchange where there is a relief in IFRS 1, which is in foreign currency differences in the consolidation of subsidiaries, where there's permission to reset the FX reserve to zero on transition date. And that's a very practical and helpful exemption, which we've seen used, because otherwise companies would have to go back and spend a very substantial amount of time unpicking the FX reserve. So that rather pushes me into allowing A2B2, because I think it's likely that in some longer term transactions you could have similar issues.
Okay, I'm going to experiment with a show of hands now. Of those on the screen, can you raise your hand if you would agree with providing the transition relief? A2B2 or?
Yeah.
Okay, those who would oppose the transition relief. Jim, Reinhard. Okay, let me rephrase the question. Of those who would oppose it, do you consider it a point that would generate your dissent from the interpretation? Reinhard is shaking his head no. Jim, I don't see raising his hand, so. All right, I think a majority support. Oh, people on the phone?
Yes.
Carl?
A2B2. I support A2B2.
Okay.
The relief.
Michael here. I also support the relief.
Okay. We will proceed on that basis then. You'll see all of this, I assume, in a pre-ballot draft.
Yeah, in fact, if we could turn to Agenda Paper 3B.
Well, I was hoping that was the transition.
Yeah. So that's the due process paper. So in this paper, we are setting out the due process steps that the Interpretation Committee has followed. And the questions are set out at the end of the paper. We are proposing that the committee doesn't need to re-expose, because we don't consider there have been substantial changes between the draft interpretation and the final interpretation. If you're satisfied the due process requirements have been met and that we've undertaken sufficient consultation, then we would like to begin the balloting process. And as Wayne said, that would start with us issuing you a pre-ballot draft. I think from our discussions today, we obviously have to go back and pick up the point about hedge documentation. If we can resolve that internally, I suggest we do. If not, we could bring it back as a sweep issue after you've seen the pre-ballot draft, and I think that would be the most expedient way of dealing with things. And finally, under the due process handbook, we're formally required to ask if any member of the interpretation committee plans to dissent from the board issuing this interpretation.
Okay, let's take the questions one at a time so that we observe the proper protocols. Does any member, raise your hand and then I'll ask those on the phone, believe that we are required to re-expose? Those on the phone?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
No, I don't like this institution of this sorted question why we have it, but I don't think that we need to re-expose that. I think that this has been a lot of support and work to win help.
Okay. We're getting some type of feedback from somebody. Can everybody be sure that your mic is muted? Let's try to proceed. Oh. Well, we can try it. Everybody unmute and then remute. No, we don't know. There it went. It went away. And came back. All right, I'm going to struggle to press ahead regardless. Do you agree that we have reached the point that it is appropriate to proceed to the balloting process? Does anyone object or believe otherwise? Those on the phone?
Hi, Carl. I agree. But there's a huge noise in the line.
Yeah, we know. We're trying to deal with to see what that is.
Thank you.
Carl, did you have anything to add on this?
No, nothing to add. Thank you.
Nothing to add. Tony?
Yeah, so perfectly comfortable that we go ahead to ballot, but just a comment that I will raise on the draft when I see it, since we haven't talked about it in the course of our two meetings, is that I continue to object to Example 4 because I think it interprets IFRS 15. So I will continue to say that when it comes in, but I thought I wanted to raise it in the meeting.
I have, in drafting, done a lot of work on trying to simplify those examples, and we can have a look at it, and if you still strongly object to... I mean, I have significantly taken a strong editorial hand to those examples.
I shall have a look. I shall look forward to it.
Okay. IT tells me that the problem may be from those of you who are on audio only. May I ask you to unmute and then again mute your phone connections?
Oh, this is okay. Disappeared.
Okay, well, the sound went away, so we will hope it continues that way. Martin, you wanted to come in?
Yeah, thanks, Wayne. I also have one comment to the example number 4, because for translation of revenue, the first in, first out method is applied. And in that example, it is assumed that the advanced payment is allocated to the first product, and therefore the spot exchange rate at that date of the first payment received is used for the translation of the first part of the revenue. Well, for the purpose of this example, this might be appropriate. However, it could be misunderstood that the FIFO method is mandatory in circumstances in which multiple payments for multiple goods received at multiple points in times have to be applied. So therefore, I would at least expect to say, for simplification, we assume in that example, however, it is not mandatory, or some wording on that. It's more or less a balloting issue.
I have addressed that point because that was in the feedback to the comment letters, and I have specifically, yeah. I think I've said the entity determines in this circumstance.
Okay, great, okay. Thanks.
Okay. All right, I assume then that everybody has agreed that we go ahead to the ballot process. Now comes the the kicker or the key point. Does any member expect to dissent or object from the board issuing the interpretation? Hand raise if I see any. This does not prohibit you from determining later that you would dissent when you see the pre-ballot. You make that decision when you sign the ballot form. But I'm not seeing anyone who expects to dissent. On the audio, anyone?
Carl, I do not expect.
They'll call me neither.
Okay. All right.
That's it.
I did that in the first round there. I have to admit that even if there were some comment letters that maybe had the same comments that I had, it was still the overwhelming support, I think, for this interpretation. I think I will not dissent that.
Okay. All right, as Michelle said, then the next thing you will see is a pre-ballot draft after we have figured out the hedge documentation issue and seen if there's something that can be done about it,
yeah,
or something that can be articulated about it.
Or needs to be done.
Or needs to be done, yeah. And I'll leave that to the people who tell me that they understand hedge accounting. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we're not too bad on time. Paper four.